Mental Health Monday on Radio City Talk with Mick Coyle.
Radio City Talk.
Yeah, welcome to Radio City Talk's flagship mental health show, Mental Health Monday. Got a couple of guests on the programme. The first is an author. We're going to be hearing about the work that he's been doing in regard to writing books, but his own mental health journey as well. Plus, it's A-level results week as we speak, and Professor Peter Kinderman from the University of Liverpool has been taking a look at some of the pressures and the psychology, if you like, of being 18, getting those results, obviously dealing with the stress of results day and the hassle that comes with it as well, moving house, leaving home, going off to university, changing your path, trying to find a different path, dealing with disappointment, dealing with things which are greater than you expected as well. Can be a very difficult time for young people. We'll talk through some of the issues in regard to that with Professor Peter Kinderman, returning to Mental Health Monday. My first guest has never been on the programme before, but I'm very pleased to say he's here today. Paul Cashin is an author, and he's got a couple of books he's going to be talking about, as well as sharing his own mental health journey. Paul, it's great to see you. Thank you for your time today. Thanks for joining us on the programme. You got a couple of books which are, I think you've written, they're not mental health books as such, they are different stories, which I'm sure you're sort of your life and the way you've gone about different choices you've made, jobs and things like that have affected that. We'll come on to the books. First and foremost, your own mental health journey. Where do you want to start with this one as well? I know anxiety is an issue that you've dealt with.
Anxiety and stress has been the bane of my existence for like the last 5 years or so, and I was even told by a doctor to go on medication, but I think that's part of the reason why people don't want to go on medication, because my experience with it completely knocked me out. I didn't feel like myself, and I think most people will tell you this: when they go on medication, they feel like zombies. It's too strong, some of them, and it just it can completely destroy you, completely disorientate you. And in a lot of cases, they will amplify the stress and anxiety that you go through for the first 2 weeks while your body adjusts to them, and that's why I ended up coming off them, and that's why a lot of people end up coming off them, because a lot of them are not specifically designed or tailored. I mean, mental health and mental illness is specifically tailored. Everyone's problems are their problems. You don't just get one. There's a huge, vast, broad spectrum of people with their own different problems, and to be able to treat all of those people as one individual case, if you like, with the same kind of medication, and there just isn't enough out there, because basically the brain is, it can go either way, it can go any way, it can do anything you imagine.
And I'm always worried, you know, because for some people medication works first time and they can get an absolute, it can be the right thing. In your own case, did you not feel like you were having almost, it wasn't individual enough to you and your circumstances?
It wasn't individual enough, it was completely ridiculous. I mean, it sent me spiraling out of control for a good couple of weeks, and I thought it would just be a day or two before it settled down. And a lot of people cannot take it, especially if you have a job. A lot of people can't take 2 weeks off work to adjust to medication and things like that, so they just don't bother. It's too stressful an ordeal to have to try and settle down onto medication. That's why a lot of people are afraid to go there with that.
At what point did you think, oh, this is something I'll need to go and see a GP about, that I might need to get medication for or might need to do something about? At what age was that?
I must have been about 25, 26 or something like that. I was working in the nightclubs in town. I was a DJ and all that kind of thing, and I was going down the wrong path, so I ended up walking away. And I just fell into a depression, and I was anxious because I couldn't get a job and all of that kind of thing. And I just thought, right, I need to do something about this before it does take a hold. And when I went to the doctors, to be honest with you, it made it worse.
And that's a real shame, isn't it? Because actually, you know, the idea that if people do want to reach out, that hopefully will be them for it. And it may well be that actually for people listening to this, that they can get the help that they desperately need. And actually, let's not put people off there. But Paul's telling his story here on Radio City Talk. Just tell us about that lifestyle then, you know, working in the clubs and the bars as well. I imagine late nights,
3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning sometimes. I was on the bar from 6 o'clock in the evening up until about 10 or 11, and then it was a DJ. Constantly drinking, always loud music, and I absolutely loved it. It was wonderful. But when I started to go down the wrong path, I had to walk away from it. And then I felt myself, I just didn't know where to go, what to do. I didn't really have any qualifications, anything like that. And I think I was born about 10 years too early, because now all the kids are all going off to computer science. I mean, my nephew is 15 years old and he's already been pushed forward a year in school and being accepted on a scholarship to the computer science place in Liverpool City Centre. There's so much more opportunity now for young people. But there wasn't anything for me. I drifted out of school at 16 with nothing and ended up working in bars in town. And up until about the age of 25, 26, I was a DJ in a club in town, and I wasn't getting into bed until about 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning. So I had to walk away. And then, as I say, my anxiety started to set in when I couldn't find work anywhere else. And I was terrified to talk about it as well, because when you see mental health on like television programs and things like that, especially like fiction, entertainment television, it's always an amplified version of it. So people don't want to talk about it because they think to themselves, is that how I'm going to be perceived? The media doesn't do enough for the general anxiety, you know, I'm not really feeling myself and all of that kind of thing, because it's not commercial, because it's not entertaining, if you like.
Do you remember any examples? Was there anything that in particular that stood out as sort of what you would now class as, you know, poor quality mental health sort of coverage or reporting or representation?
I don't really think it's poor quality. I mean, all the things that get represented on television and that kind of thing, they do happen to people. And I'm not saying that it's not real or anything like that, but the beginnings of it and all of that kind of thing, I don't think they tackle that as much as they should in the media. I think people need to be aware of the early warning signs, and they don't really show the effects of mental health or mental illness on television until it goes a lot further. And I think people need to be made aware of the early signs.
With that in mind as well, and people's perceptions, did people look at you as a young man, early 20s, working in a bar, nightclubbing, I guess the opportunities in regard to drinking drugs, which may come or not with that? I guess some people would think, oh, that's some sort of hedonistic lifestyle. That oh, isn't Paul doing well? He's doing really well for himself. You know, every night's a party night. Was that part of the problem, that actually there was a perception that you should be having a great time?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I went down that road, the drugs are not addictive because they make you feel bad. Drugs are addictive because they make you feel good, and you constantly chase that high. And that's what a lot of people fall into. They say, oh, it won't get me, I only do it when I go out and blah, blah, blah. But it will get you. And that's one of the things. But I think I was trying to escape where I was because I saw everyone else moving around me. It does sound hedonistic, and it does sound like people would perceive that. But from the inside, I was looking at the rest of the world, getting jobs, getting married, buying houses and things like that, moving on when I wasn't. I was stuck in that. So I tried to enjoy that situation as much as I could, but I could see everyone else around me moving a lot faster. And that's where my anxiety really started to set in.
Yeah, I think it's always interesting that when you look at other people and presume that their life is better, they might look at you and go, oh, I'm tied down to a mortgage, and there's Paul DJing in nightclubs until 3-4 in the morning.
Yeah.
And you might be looking at them thinking, well, that, you know, that actually, opportunity that you've got is actually...
I would absolutely love to have a mortgage and a house and all that kind of thing. That's what it was.
When medication didn't work for you, you started writing. Was that the next step that you took where you thought, well, I'll do something else? What was the next step you took after you thought, well, medication's not going to work in the current form for me?
Well, it was just a change in routine. All the things that can stress, and it's a lot easier said than done. People, as I say, people can't take time off. People can't just change the routine because it is incredibly difficult. I think that was one of the things, actually, that served as a plus for me, not being tied down to a mortgage and all of that kind of thing. I was able to change my routine, so I stopped going out into town, I stopped drinking, I stopped going to all the places where I had temptation and things like that. But then that huge shift in life can be really disorientating for people. You can't just change who you are, and you can't change what you're used to. So going from one extreme, being out until 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning, to the other, where I was going to bed at like 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock in the evening, getting up at 8 o'clock and then sitting down trying to write. That really, really shook me, and I wasn't able to earn any money and that kind of thing. So, that really shook me. And I think that's what people don't get the opportunity to try and change their lives. And I think it should be made a lot easier for people to try and do that. Like, but you can't just take 3 or 4 weeks off work. And nobody would expect an employer to make that kind of concession for somebody because they felt anxious or stressed, and they don't want to say that in work either, because all the people around that, they don't want the people around them who are going through exactly the same thing that they are work-wise and like through life to say, well, what have you got to be stressed about and all of that kind of thing, which is why people always, I think a lot of the time, try and keep it to themselves, and they really, really shouldn't.
Am I right in saying that homelessness was an issue for you at one point?
Yeah, it was at one point, yeah. I mean, that really threw me over the edge. I really had to... And also, I was dealing with addiction at the time, and I just wanted to escape, which made the feeling that I needed to escape you through my addiction even worse, which was another reason I started to sit down and write as well.
Is that part of the thing there whereby you knew that your life was going in a certain path, but actually the safety net to be there to allow you to get onto a different path wasn't there. That actually, if you wanted to sit down and become an author and write stories and get up at 8 o'clock in the morning, go to bed at 10 o'clock at night, there are a lot of people that might be a quote, you know, normal lifestyle, but actually coming from the lifestyle that you'd had, the lack of safety net there, presumably that made the situation worse because you thought, I know the path and I know what I want to do, but I can't make that happen.
Yeah, I mean, I was, I was practically homeless. I ended up living with someone in his flat, but then he got diagnosed with cancer and I ended up having to take care of him. So that was just made the stress and anxiety go through the roof then. I wasn't able to go back to the doctor and ask for any other tablets or pills to try and help me cope with it because I thought, if that's going to send me around the bend for 2 weeks, no one's going to be there to take care of him. So I really had to try and focus and center my attention on something that I could do to take my mind off all of my own problems, and that ended up being writing.
Paul Cashin is with us in the studio. He's an author and he's telling us about his mental health journey. The flatmate getting cancer, that must have been a real curveball. When you're thinking, right, I need to get myself sorted, and suddenly somebody else's issue becomes an issue for you as well, it must be really difficult to deal with.
It was absolutely awful. I mean, he had a kidney out. He's a pensioner and he went into the hospital to have a kidney out, and I was just thinking, he was only in there for a day. I mean, he was in literally one night, and then he came home and then he was fine. But I was thinking, oh my God. But it went on for months and months and months. And because that really started, really, really made me anxious. I ended up to a point where I couldn't really go out at one point because it made me hypervigilant. Where stress and anxiety starts out, it can rapidly escalate to something that you simply cannot handle. I've tried everything. I've spoken to people on the phone. I've researched everything on the internet about how to stop it from progressing and that kind of thing. But honestly, I think the information that's out there covers too broad a spectrum. There isn't anything, as I say, really tailored to anyone specifically. And I had to wait months and months to get in to speak to someone about it. And then they just put me on mood stabilizers, but I say I can't take those because I've got other things that I need to do.
Yeah, it's a shame actually that the reaching out, you weren't able to get the help that you were looking for. Again, we'll say to people though, if they are looking for help, do reach out and hopefully find the pathway that's right for you. At what point then did you start to feel a benefit of the writing, of becoming an author, of deciding you're going to put some stuff down on a piece of paper?
It helped me focus. I had to, because of what I was going through at home, looking after him and all that kind of thing, it really helped me focus. It helped me focus all my energy and attention onto one thing. I mean, I would get up, I would make sure he was all right, I would help him get dressed, I would make dinner and all of that kind of thing, and then I would sit at the computer and write. And all the stress and anxiety, for me, that's what helped me get through it. That's what helped me work through it. As I say, and I don't mean to disparage the mental health services out there when I say all this, but it just didn't work for me because maybe I spoke to the wrong people. But as I say, you do need to share it with as many people as possible because they will understand, and that was where I went wrong. I waited until it was too late, and by then nobody understood because I kept my mouth shut until it had really come to a head. If you're feeling anxious or stressed and things like that, then you do need to go to your GP, but not just your GP, share it with people around you as well.
Let's move on to the books, because people might think your books are self-help type books telling your mental health story. They're not that. They're individual stories. They're thrillers. Yep. The first
one, Dissociation, that was inspired by mental health. That's about a woman with split personalities and a social worker and the social worker realizes that something bad is happening in the home, or something bad has happened, and she has to go through all the different personalities to figure out what that was. But unfortunately, the father of the patient is the chief of police, and she's got to go through him as well.
Was that fun to write?
Yes.
Almost having had your experiences and then sort of played around your own roles that you'd had to then sort of play those different roles while writing a book. Was that part of the therapy there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you had to go and research everything. As I say, I felt completely isolated from the world around me, and being able to go online and to be able to work out this story and to really research how that kind of thing can affect the mind and the people around it, it really brought, that was all part of the research I did into mental health, and that's what really brought it home for me. That's what helped me navigate through it, not just looking for my specific problem online, trying to work through it that way. I researched all manner of different types of mental illness, and that really, really settled it for me. And it got me thinking, do you know what? Things could be worse.
I think it's dissociative identity disorder is the issue that you take home with the book. But yeah. You talk about your own mental health issues, plus the fact you were a carer. Those two things suddenly play in as well. Did you find that you were looking for an answer to your own problems, if you like? Because this is essentially becomes a mystery. That people are trying to work out what's going on. Is that representative of you in your own head thinking, really, what's going on?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I've always loved mystery stories anyway, but to be able to sit down and write something like that and to be able to work in the mental health aspect and to be able to, from the social worker's point of view, trying to figure out what's happened and trying to help the person through it. And from the perspective of all the other characters around them, watching it happen and all that kind of thing, trying to protect those that they feel need to be protected and all of that kind of thing, it was great fun to write, and it really, really helped.
So I was going to ask you about that. So when people are reading it, will they read it from the point of view of maybe, if they read it from the point of view of somebody who has had mental health issues, or they read about it from the point of view of somebody who's been in caring, maybe?
They read
maybe
it
somebody
from
who's even worked in the police commissioner's office.
Yeah, they read it from the social worker's perspective.
They read it from that point of view. But will they see, do you think, different elements of those stories contained within each of those characters, if you like? A little bit of something for everybody.
Absolutely, definitely. I mean, I've been told that the characters are well-rounded, thank God. you can see everything from everyone's different point of view. And it did bring it home for me. I mean, the parents of the patient, like the mother especially, who had nothing to do with the police, she just wants her daughter to be well cared for and she's trying to protect her. Researched absolutely everything online from everyone's different perspective and used my own personal experience as well, from caring for my friend who, as I say, had cancer, from someone who has battled with mental illness and stress and anxiety and all of that kind of thing. And watching him when he went through cancer, battling the anxiety and being frightened and all of that kind of thing, there's too many different ways to explore it and I couldn't get my head around it until I wrote it down.
Your second book, Murder on the Riviera.
Yes.
Kind of the language around that almost like speaks for itself, doesn't it? But does that play around the issue around insecure home life, actually not being in a home or having to leave a house? Because doesn't it start with somebody who's looking for accommodation?
It starts with three friends who met when they were at school and who fell out a few years previous. The main character calls one of them and says she's been kicked out and she needs a place to go. When she gets there, she meets her old boyfriend and the three of them realise that they're scraping the bottom of the barrel at that time in their own personal lives and they decide that they need to get out of town to be able to get a new life. And the villain in it, they blackmail the villain and then they all run off to the Riviera and then the villain follows them. And once they've got all set up and they blackmail the villain for millions and millions and then run away. And then she follows them. And then someone dies. But they all live in a big gated community around a lagoon. And the villains ripped everybody off and made friends and then enemies of everybody. And it's a proper old-fashioned whodunit.
It absolutely sounds like it. But then following back from your own story, moving into a new accommodation and then facing a challenge there, which you didn't know you were going to face, there's an echo of that. Has that been a flight of fancy of how would you escape this situation to the point where, you know, you're the equivalent of robbing a bank, you know, committing a heist, Ocean's 11 style?
Through my addiction, I was trying to escape the life I was in. But then I started to think, oh, God, I really can't. Really can't go on with this because this is going to kill me. But then, as I say, that elevated the anxiety when away from that because that awful as it sounds, was my safety net. That's what helped me escape and everything. So once I was able to beat the addiction, the anxiety got even worse and I started to have to really plan out what I was going to do and plan my life. But then, when things came to a halt where I had to stay home and take care of someone, it just makes your imagination wander. It makes your mind run 100 miles an hour and thought, well, I may as well write it down.
You obviously have a sort of a keen eye for detail in regard to the complexities of these types of stories, the characters and the interlinking stories that you got to weave along the lines. Have you got like three or four books planned out? Is it all based on your experiences? Do you feel like you're maybe just going to sort of put some stuff down on paper, which is, you know, completely free of some of the issues that you've faced in life so far?
Well, I never sat down and wrote one book from beginning to end. It was always I wrote like 50 pages and then it was like, oh, I can't do this. And then I would go back and then it would go away from it and do something else. And then it would start another 50 pages of another book. So there's another three novels that are already half done. And then, as I say, with the first one, I pushed it to the side because I had writer's block. I couldn't think of anything and then started on the next one and then went back to it. So I've got three choices at the moment. I'm just working out at the moment which one's going to be the next book.
Excellent stuff. Books2read.com has got loads of information. If you want to go on there and type in Paul's name, Paul Cashin, C-A-S-H-I-N. There's Murder on the Riviera and also Dissociation as well. You can check that out, book2read.com. When can we expect the next one? Do you know? Do you have a deadline? Do you set yourself deadlines for these things?
I do set myself deadlines, but then I set myself deadlines for writing them, but then because I edit them myself and I have to go back, you have to read them like 10 or 20 times, and that's what really takes the time up. You have to sit there and go and read every single sentence very, very carefully, and that's what really takes the time. So I'm hoping the next one's going to be out in about 3 months, and the next one will be called Gloria.
Excellent stuff. And in terms of your the anxieties and the stress, have you found yourself in a better place now?
Yes, absolutely, definitely. I mean, with this, it's really helped me. I've reconnected with the family. My anxiety and stress is under control. The friend I'm living with is doing much, much better. He's in remission now. And I've just finished my second book and I'm just about to start work on the third. So very excited.
Brilliant stuff. Sorry to hear that, you know, the pathways that you went looking for didn't provide you the answers that you were looking for. But it's so interesting to hear the journey that you've been on has maybe found those answers.
I threw up obstacles in my own way, I think, but I think that was largely due to panic. I think if I'd gone to someone and spoke to them earlier about it, then I probably would have got the help that I needed. But because I left it too late and because I panicked about it in my own personal experience, I think the longer you leave it, the worse it gets. So if you are feeling anxious and stressed, you really do need to deal with it as soon as you feel that, because soon, if you leave it for a long time, it will be unbelievably difficult to get away from it.
Paul, it's been good to get you on the programme today. Thank you for your time. Really appreciate
you
joining us.
Me.
Paul Cashin is an author. Books2read.com. That's books2read.com. Murder on the Riviera and also Dissociation as well. And thanks for being our guest on Mental Health Monday on Radio City Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Mental Health Monday
on Radio City Talk
with Mick Coyle.
Tackling the stigma.
Radio City Talk.
Okay, so it's Radio City Talk. My name is Mick Coyle. Of course, A-level results day very much nearly upon us, and the life-changing decisions which could be made as a result of the results, which might go one way or another, can be a really difficult time as well. And actually, the whole idea around how people think about their lives going into that age, such a key age, 18, 19, 20 years of age, feels like your whole life is ahead of you. Peter Kinderman joins us on the programme, University of Liverpool's Professor of Clinical Psychology. Peter, thank you for your time. Do you remember when you were 18 years of age receiving those all-important results?
I did. It was by post in my day.
Was it easier by post?
I'm not sure it's easy however you do it. I think it's difficult if you turn up at school with your mates, especially if the results are disappointing. I think it's difficult waiting for the post to arrive and then being on your own. I just don't think it's an easy time. It's easy if you get grades that are as good as or better than you hoped for. It's just really difficult, whatever happens, if you get disappointing grades.
Is this the sort of the best way or the best system that we've got, if you like? Because it does feel for some like it's either a cliff edge or an elevator, depending on how the results go. But you don't know whether or not you're in danger going off the cliff or whether or not you're able to jump in the elevator.
Well, I don't know about the details in the sense of if we're going to have an exam-based culture, I'm not sure whether there's a better or a worse way of giving people the results. What I do know is that a lot of psychologists and others are concerned about the degree to which both in the UK and in a lot of a lot of countries, whether industrialised or not, people are getting very focused on exams and performance and grades and scores and tests. And all of that puts a great deal of pressure on people. It tends to make kids very anxious and either worried about their future or disconnected from their future, depending on how they interpret things. And it puts a great deal of pressure on people at crunch points in their careers like this. A more flexible approach that stretched learning and success and indeed failure over our lives would be more attractive, to be honest.
Yeah, and in terms of that and how you see yourself, how you value your own self-worth, there's a danger, isn't there, that you get these sorts of pieces of paper that have these numbers or letters on them and you make a judgment on yourself based on it, whereas actually it's only one of a number of different things.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I did well at my A-levels and not so well at my university grades, and then well after that. I'm a professor at a university now, so, you know, it's gone up and down and up again. And All three of those stages, you know, getting my A-level results, I'm really proud of. I don't tend to talk about my degree result, and then I talk about the success I've had subsequently. It stays with you for 30, 40 years, absolutely, yes.
And in terms of how young people prepare for what's to come next, is there a golden rule? Is there something we need to follow? So much of what you're doing when you're at that age feels like you're flying by the seat of your pants, but can we prepare our young people for the sorts of changes which are going to be coming in their lives, sort of no matter what results they get for A-level results day?
We can do a few things to help kids, yes. So, I mean, the first thing is that it's still the case, I mean, despite some of our worries from time to time, that parents and families are, you know, the best source of support for people. So, you know, kids should be surrounded by their friends and their families, and we should be supportive of them. We should also, if we can, help people prepare a little bit in terms of saying, look, if it doesn't go well, then there's all sorts of other things you can do in your life and look at. And then you give some examples of people who've done well despite being a little bit disappointed at A-levels, for instance. And then when the results happen, you're there to remind people there are other things and we can make plans rather than it being a devastating negative experience. So people around you who you can bounce ideas off. And then, I mean, there are some, they're not perfect, they're not golden rules, they're not even rules, but there are some things that help. So we know that physical activity helps. People get very, very stressed and people get very anxious and people get very depressed, and physical activity helps. So, you know, going for a cycle ride with your dad might not be a bad idea. Going for a run might not be a bad idea. Going down to gym with your mates might not be a bad idea. It's important to stay connected to people. So, you know, even if the results are disappointing, probably do go out with your mates in the evening and celebrate, commiserate. Make some plans, don't isolate yourself, try to stay connected, try to stay active, and I guess make plans. I mean, it's all common sense stuff, but I think it's suggesting to people that it is a big day, people can do very well, but also there are things that we can do if things don't go terribly well, and there's potential solutions that we can develop even if the worst happens. Letting people know that it's not quite as much of a cliff edge as people fear sometimes.
Yeah, and I wonder whether from a society point of view, you know, we kind of provide young people with the platform and go, you know what, this is school, that means GCSEs, then it's A-levels, and then it's university, all the other options as well. So then if things don't go according to plan, it feels as if that story, that journey has come to an end, whereas you kind of realise as you get older, Peter, that life isn't about that journey. That's the pathway that might be the pathway for you. But actually, it's just a series of options, of doors that you're taking, and one door might close for you, but that doesn't mean there's not a million other doors that might open or reopen in the future.
Well, I think that's right. I think it's also the case that, well, I mean, it is very useful for kids, for them to know that there's not exactly a ladder, but, you know, a steady progression for them. So one of the things that you don't want to say to a 17-year-old is the future is extending in front of you and it's completely uncertain. So the idea of school, GCSEs, A-levels, university, master's, career, whatever, that it's, you know, it's good to have a framework for the future, right? That's a positive thing. On the other hand, you need to build into it a bit of flexibility. So that's the basic framework, but there are a number of different routes that you can, yeah, you know, there's a number of ways that you can get from London to York. Going up the A1 is kind of okay, but there's a number of ways that you can do it. So I think we need a plan and a vision for the future, but also a bit of flexibility built in. So if it goes horribly wrong, you've got resits, you've got possibly clearing for university, you've got taking a year out, you've got thinking again. You know, there's a plan and there's a progression that's helpful because you know broadly in what direction your future is facing. And then there's flexibility. And that's why it's so valuable to be able to talk about these things with family, because if you've put all of your eggs in one basket, it's a little bit fearful. If what you can do is say, right, OK, well, we're still on target, but we might have to go to clearing, or we might have to wait a year, or we might have to do something different. That's flexibility of thought, flexibility in the face of disappointment is extremely useful.
We've got Peter Kinderman with us, University of Liverpool, Professor of Clinical Psychology. Can I ask you as well about ages? You know, 18 years of age used to be, right, that's adulthood now, you know, you can find your own way in the world. I think now that you can see now that actually you're still quite vulnerable at the age of 18. Sure, you're an adult, sure, you can do all those different things, but you've not quite got the skill set to be able to maybe see the wider picture in life. And I think sometimes we presume that our young people will be able to just go and cope and achieve, and many of them will. But 18, you know, it's still a relatively vulnerable age, isn't it?
I think it's a very vulnerable age, to be honest. I mean, you know, kids develop as they age. I mean, that's an obvious thing to say. But there's no magic point at which you become an adult. You get, you know, competent at running one thing, and you get good at keeping yourself safe physically, and then you get a little bit safer at keeping yourself safe emotionally, and then you start to be able to get better and better at making plans. You know, it develops, right, as you get older. I remember, you know, distinctly being in my 20s, even 30s, with kids and thinking, I wonder when I'm going to grow up. People don't just pass a magical age of 17 and then they're adults. And none of us, not you, not me, not anybody, exists, like, you know, as John Donne said, as an island entire unto himself. Yeah, we all rely on people. We rely on legal advice. We rely on medical advice. We rely on the advice of our friends and colleagues to help us out emotionally. So, yeah, there isn't a magical point at which it's kind of, right, off you go, you're an adult, you know, go off and sort yourself out. I think we all rely on friends, we rely on colleagues, we rely on supporters. We all get it wrong, we all worry, we are all uncertain about the future. That's just being human. It's not being childish or immature, it's just being human.
Absolutely. Peter, you've got a great blog where people can find out more information about your various musings on various different things that we're
getting. I think you meant to say evidence-based advice, I think is what you're looking for.
That's exactly the phrase that I was looking for. peterkinderman.blogspot.co.uk is also at Peter Kinderman on social media. We really appreciate your thoughts on that one. Thanks for joining us as well. We really appreciate your time here on Radio City Talk.
Fantastic. Thanks.
Mental Health Monday with Mick Coyle.
On Radio City Talk.